turn your attention, please, to the book of 2 Kings in chapter 8, to the story of a widow and a would-be king. Two stories, actually. The story here in chapter 8 is really a sequel to chapter 4, where Elisha, you may remember if you were with us, was invited to stay with the Shunammite couple, where they received what we call Shunammite hospitality, a couple who loved the Lord God of Israel. And they wanted to extend hospitality to Elisha whenever he came through town. And so eventually, as we study, they even built a room for him on their roof that was plush accommodations with any and every cultural advantage that they could afford. Now, evidently, according to this sequel, this woman's husband has died. She is alone with her son and household. And Elisha, knowing that a famine was coming her way, commanded that she and her son and family leave, go to the area of the Philistines in order to survive the famine. And so where the author picks up that story, he's picking up that conversation in review. So let's start at verse 1 of this chapter. Pick it up there. Now Elisha literally had spoken to the woman in the past, whose son he had restored to life, saying, "Arise and go with your household and sojourn wherever you can sojourn. For the Lord has called for a famine, and it shall even come on the land for 7 years. So the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. And it came about at the end of 7 years that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went out to appeal to the king for her house and for her field. Now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Please relate to me all the great things that Elisha has done." Now, we have to stop there because as you've been with us in this study, that verse probably raises some questions in your mind as it did mine. You remember the story of Gehazi, who in chapter 5 is stricken with the leprosy of Naaman, and he ceases to be the servant of the man of God. The question is now, how can he be referred to years later as Elisha's servant? Good question. It mired me down for some time as I read more opinions that I care to share with you, but of all of the things that I researched, two thoughts or possibilities seem to make the most sense. Opinion number one says that basically this is not occurring in chronological order. And certainly Jeremiah and Ezra later in 1st and 2nd Chronicles did not put things in strict chronological order, much like if you've ever read the Gospels, maybe you've been somewhat confused, as the synoptics never really in strict chronological order gave us the stories of Christ's own life. So here, this was occurring earlier than the incident with Naaman. The problem that still raises to my mind is this is occurring 7 years after the raising of the Shunammite's son, and so that poses some problems. Of all the other opinions, I think this second opinion made the most sense. I'm voting for it. You can choose to disagree and be wrong, but it's based on the fact that Gehazi's role was one of the most prominent roles in Israel's time. The servant of the man of God could inherit the role as the man of God. In fact, it happened already with Elisha. He had been the servant of the man of God, and he now became the leading prophet. And so Gehazi was in step, I believe, to inherit the role once Elisha went home to be with his king in heaven. So I happen to believe that this title is as much a title as it is a role, a title that would stick with Gehazi in the eyes of the people and in their memories as long as he lived. There are other titles that have stuck as well. I'll give you illustrations, such as Rahab the harlot. Long after she left that profession, she was still referred to as the harlot. And centuries later in the New Testament, we hear her referred to as Rahab the harlot, much to her chagrin, I'm sure. We have in our own culture the idea of one particular role, and that is the president. Long after that man has left his office, whether we believe he's deserving or not, we still refer to him as Mr. President. It sticks. I happen to believe that Gehazi was known as being the servant of the man of God, even though it was in the past tense, as long as he lived. So here in the king's court, he's still referred to as that title, even though he has long since left that position. Verse 5, and it came about as he was relating to the king how he had restored to life, that is Elisha, the one who was dead, that behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and for her field. And Gehazi said, "My lord, O king, this is the woman and this is her son whom Elisha restored to life." And the king asked the woman, she related it to him. So the king appointed for her a certain officer, saying, "Restore all that was hers, and all the produce of the field from the day that she left the land, even until now." That's interesting. Not only give her back the land, but give her all the wages of the produce from her property over the previous 7 years. Give that to her in one lump sum as well. Now, at first review, it's easy to overlook the tough times that this woman endured. We're given the silver lining in full view, and it's easy to forget the storm that has just swept through her life. I fear that if we don't take some time to look at the storm, we really can't appreciate God's solution. I know getting up this morning, I was thrilled to see the sunshine. Actually, I could see the moon. There weren't any clouds in the sky, and the AP News had said, by way of my CompuServe, that it was going to be raining today, and I thought, oh my, all the women that are going to have to walk with their babies and kids through this first-class parking lot over here to get to our auditorium will be mired down. And then it stormed last night. I don't know if it stormed where you live, but it rained and thundered. And so when I got up this morning and saw it clear, I appreciated that much more because of the previous storm. I think that's the case in many things. We tend to overlook the value of the solution and how wonderful it is because we fail to remember the storm. Well, I want to suggest to you that the sequel to her biography really gives us some modern-day challenges. Let me give you two truths about tough times, and I'll relate it to her life as we work through this. If you have notes and you care to follow along, here's the first truth. Number one, God most clearly works in the lives of those who are willing to accept the penalties of obedience. Now, I know the word penalty doesn't sound really spiritual, and preachers aren't supposed to, you know, use words like penalties for obedience, but that's where we happen to live. Don't overlook the fact that her obedience to the prophet brought the penalty of obedience. That is, it brought the storm. It brought tough, difficult times. Don't overlook the fact that obedience to the prophet would thrust her into the unknown. Would you look again at verse 1 as Elisha speaks to her? "Arise and go with your household and sojourn," notice this, "wherever you can." Thanks a lot. That's a big help. He never gives her a forwarding address. He never says, "Now listen, ma'am, I want you to leave here. I want you to go 5 miles and turn left and 4 more, turn right. There's somebody there waiting for you." No, he says, "I want you to leave here with your son and go wherever you can. Wherever you can find a place to survive, live there." And so by obeying that, it means stepping into the unknown. It means leaving her home. It means leaving her families. It means leaving her network. It means turning her back, perhaps forever, on the estate that she and her husband, who is now dead, had enjoyed, had built with their own hands. It meant going to a strange land that would never be inviting to this God-fearer. She will eventually land in the area the Philistines rule, in their fertile region. She will survive, but it would be an inhospitable place for her to survive. How do you raise this question in my mind as I studied? How do you determine the providence of God in your life? What is it in your life that has to occur before you say, "Wow, God is really at work in my life"? It's triumphant times, not tough times. And yet this woman had God at work in her life, even though her times were now tough, difficult, challenging. Let me give you another truth that really rephrases the first one, just says it a different way. And it's this: the solutions of God are most often experienced by those willing to trust Him with a difficult future. The truth was, when this widow obeyed the prophet, she abandoned any and all hope of a secure future. Go out and live wherever you can. And there was never a promise. And then 7 years later, you can come back and I'll restore your home and 7 years' wages of all that your land produced. Well, who wouldn't go? It's a 7-year vacation. She had no guarantee. She was then, in effect, as it were, by obedience to the prophet, giving God the permission to make her life difficult. Have you ever done that? Have you ever been right in the middle of it, struggling with how God is at work in your life? Or maybe it seems that He's not at work at all, but you're surrounded by difficult, tough, challenging, oppressive times. where you've had to reach the conclusion, either I am going to say, Lord, forget this, or Lord, you have, from a human standpoint, my permission to make my life tough. And now, 7 years later, here comes this woman with nothing but a thin prayer to ever hope of having her home returned, her estate given back to her again. Some of you have had the privilege of being raised in one home all through your childhood. It's kind of a rare thing today, but maybe you were like me, you were able to stay in one home. I was raised in one home for 18 years. When I went to college, my family moved. A few years ago, I got the bug to just go back and see that home again. I hadn't been back since college. And so when we were in Virginia on some time away, I got in the car and headed back to Redbrook Road. I can remember pulling up in front of that home and parking on the curb. Maybe this has happened to you too, but I remembered seeing that front yard, which had seemed so huge, was now this little postage stamp of a front yard. And it also had grass on it. We weren't used to seeing that. I got out and was walking across the front yard, and to my right was that tree that bordered our property with our neighbors, and they had lived in that home too for some 20 years. And that tree was the favorite climbing tree of the neighborhood. There was one branch that sort of swung down and then went horizontal with the property, and it was perfect. And that, I noticed that branch was gone. I just was taking all that I could in, stepped up on the porch and rang the doorbell, knowing this was going to be a crazy moment for whoever lived in this home. And a woman came to the door with a baby on her hip. And I immediately started talking. She probably thought I was a salesman or something. I said, no, ma'am, I just want you to know I lived here for 18 years. I was raised in this home, and I just come back to see it. And she said something like, cool. So I had courage. Maybe she would let me in. And so I said, would you mind if I just kind of came in and walked through your home? Oh, my. She actually said, sure, come on in. And she left me unattended and went about her business, and I just meandered through her home, poking my nose in closets and remembering all kinds of things, and it really struck me. And then after I was there for a while, you know, just, well, immediately, some of the memories. I remember stepping in to the front and that little living room over there, and it hit me that I'm in here with my shoes on, and I was trained never to do that. I was tempted to take my shoes off, but I didn't. My mother would have never allowed it, my three brothers and I. And I walked in, and to my right, noticed the little dining room, and there was the subceiling that my father had hung with his own hands, and walked through that and into that little kitchen that somehow was the place where all four of us boys would eat. If my father wasn't on the road, we'd eat in the little dining room. And I walked through there and just looked around at how small everything was, and could picture my mother at the sink and one row of cupboards. There was a door to the side, and I opened that and peered out that door. We used to scamper in and out, letting the flies in and everything, the dog and everything else, and down that narrow strip of yard. And I did notice that the big bush right beside the porch was gone. That was the bush that gave my mother an ample supply of switches for four bare-legged boys. And God had answered my prayer. That bush had been destroyed only 20 years too late. God answers prayer slowly. Made my way down into the basement, and that basement was about the length of the house. That was the place where we all just hung out, and I remembered all the ping pong games, and there was the place where I slaved through piano lessons. But it had all changed. They had divided that basement. They'd chopped it up into three little rooms, and I thought, what a dumb idea to do that. Can't have the world's longest races with matchbox cars anymore. It was all chopped up. Finally made it up to the rooms upstairs, second floor, and the little room that had become mine whenever my older brother had left to go to college, and stood in that little bedroom and remembered. And among the things I remembered was, of course, that spring night when I got out of my bed alone, knelt kneeling there without my parents knowing, and gave my life to Christ. There will always be something very special about 7417 Redbrook Road. You have a place like that? Maybe you left it to come here. When I read this story, I immediately thought back to that, because here's a woman whose home that she cherished, all the memories, her husband built it. I imagine maybe she went back. She undoubtedly saw it, knew it was standing, knew it was there. But when she drove back, she wasn't invited. In fact, I'm sure the people in there were rather intimidated that she had arrived back in the land and afraid she'd stake her claim Or perhaps there were squatters on the property and they didn't know her, but I doubt she was able to go in and rummage through things and walk through. But maybe from a distance she looked at the estate and the home and she could see outlining that estate, that upper room that she and her husband had made for the prophet of God, and maybe her mind was filled with the memories of dinner conversations and happy times, the room where her son was restored to life, and all of that. And now there isn't a prayer that she'd ever get it back. You see, she had been willing to entrust a difficult future to God. And the only hope that she had was to personally talk to the king, the highest judge in the land. And maybe he would be unique. Maybe he would give rather than grasp this youngest son of Ahab and Jezebel. He had seen his father ripped from Naboth the vineyard that he coveted. Why would this son ever give away property? She had only the remotest hope. But did you notice the timing of God as you moved to the solution that we came to so quickly? Just as she's walking past the palace guards into the courtroom of the king to stake her claim to tell her story, Gehazi is in the middle of telling the story of this woman. Look back at verse 5 again. And it came about as Gehazi was relating to the king how Elisha had restored to life the one who was dead, that behold, look, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and for her field. And Gehazi said, "My lord, O king, this is the woman, this is the son whom Elisha restored to life." Implied, "We were just talking about you. I was just telling the king your story. Good night, what a coincidence." Not on your life. No coincidence. Did it just so happen that this wayward Israelite king who cared little about God and less for the prophet of God suddenly struck with a desire to hear the life story of Elisha? "I'd like to hear about my enemy. Come in and tell me his whole story." Is that a coincidence? Was it a coincidence that Gehazi, the man who knew more about Elisha, was the one invited into the king's courtroom that day to tell the story? Did it just so happen on the day that Gehazi arrives that this woman comes to make her plea before the king? Did it just so happen that she came in just after Gehazi was finishing the story about her and her son, and look, here she is? Did it just so happen that she arrived without a court representative, which was the custom of that day? And the only man aside from Elisha who could be her representative and validate her claim to the estate and tell the king she's saying the truth was there at that moment. For those who are willing to wait on the Lord, there is no such thing as a coincidence. There's a verse that we well know and we wear out. "For we know that all things work together for good, to them who love God, to them who are called according to His purpose." Ultimately, as the next verse says, that we might be conformed to the image of His Son. We like to take that verse and attach it to our week-long prayer. "Okay, Lord, work it out." We like to attach that to the journal that exposes a six-month crisis or challenge. If anybody deserves that verse, it is this woman who waited for 7 years to see God work. And when He does, there aren't any coincidences. I like the way someone wrote it. He said that a coincidence is just a small miracle where God prefers to remain anonymous. That's good. But we ought to be praying for God to give us the perception and the insight to see Him in the small things. The timing of a letter, a phone call, a conversation, something that happened, something that worked, and something that didn't. Some difficulty, some interruption. Those are God's hands at work. And for those who are willing to trust Him with the uncertainties of life and the penalties of obedience, like this woman, you can see His hand at work eventually, clearly. So there's a happy ending here. By the way, there's a happy ending to every Christian here. Eventually, when we stand before the court of heaven and we make our claim, and our representative happens to be none other than God the Son, who validates your claim to the Father's estate, and you are allowed home. Well, the chapter moves on. And I don't mean to twist our thoughts, but I want to take these two stories together. This is a story of temptation, and it's hidden, it's secret. It goes well with the story we've just finished. There was a woman who succeeded, now a man who failed. Would you look at verse 7? It gives us some insight into the power of temptation that we need today. Verse 7. Then Elisha came to Damascus. Now, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, was sick. And it was told him, saying, The man of God has come here. And the king said to Hazael, Take a gift in your hand and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, Will I recover from this sickness? Always fascinates me, by the way, to see people who have denied God throughout their whole lives upon their sickbed call for the man of God. Still happens today. So Hazael, verse 9, went to meet him and took a gift in his hand, and even every good thing of Damascus, 40 camels loads. They're loaded down. And he came and stood before him and said, Your son, Ben-Hadad, I imagine Elisha chuckled, my son, okay, king of Aram, has sent me to you saying, Will I recover from this sickness? Then Elisha said to him, Go say to him, You shall surely recover, but the Lord has shown me that he will certainly die. Now, it's one thing to have one problem passage to deal with in a sermon. It's another thing to have two. Here's the second. At first glance, the verse is troublesome to me, and to you probably, as you've read it. It seems that Elisha told Hazael to report a lie. You're going to get well, O king, when in fact the king was going to die. Is Elisha telling him to lie? Well, as we work through this, I think you'll find the answer, as I did. Verse 11, and he, you need to write in the margin of your Bible here, the word Elisha, with he. And he, that is Elisha, fixed his gaze steadily on him until he, that is Hazael, was ashamed. That is quite a clue. Elisha delivers his prophecy about the king's recovery. He will recover from this illness. He's not going to die from it, but he will die unexpectedly. He never says how the king will die. But after saying that to Hazael, he stares at him. He looks at him. His eyes lock on with Hazael's. And it's as if the prophet is reading the soul of this man and reading the intentions of his heart. And after a long space of time where the prophet of God is simply looking at Hazael, the Bible tells us that Hazael was ashamed. Maybe he had to look away. Maybe he shuffled his feet and, you know, was distracted by the bird or whistled or something. He could not keep looking at the prophet of God. He was ashamed. That tells you that he was hiding something. He had a secret that no one knew. Then suddenly, in verse 11, of all things, Elisha begins to weep. Elisha just breaks down, crying in front of this man. What's going on? Verse 12, and Hazael said, Why does my Lord weep? Then he answered, Because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, their young men you will kill with the sword, and their little ones you will dash in pieces, and their women with child you will rip up. And Hazael said, But what is your servant who is but a dog that he should do this great thing? And Elisha answered, and here's the key to understanding. The Lord has shown me that you will be king over Aram. Elisha never said, Hazael, you're going to murder the king and take his throne. But he did say, Hazael, the king is going to recover from his illness, but he is going to die. And then he stares at him until Hazael becomes ashamed. Elisha was reading the heart of this man who was at that very moment feigning loyalty to the king, but in his heart he was planning a coup attempt. He was feigning love and concern over the king who was sick, and yet he was thinking in his heart, now is the time to take the throne from this weak man. Now is the time to kill him, be rid of him. Now's the time for me to grasp the throne. And Elisha had read the intentions of his heart. Notice verse 15. And it came about on the morrow, that is, he couldn't hardly wait 24 hours, that he, Hazael, took the cover and dipped it in water and spread it on the king's face so that he died. And Hazael became king in his place. Now this is a clever assassination. The word cover in my translation is literally the word machber, which means to intertwine. It means woven. Many that I read believed it was a reference to the mosquito net that was held in place around the bed of a sick person to keep away the distracting mosquitoes and flies and other bugs. According to historians that I read, it was a common practice in that day to dip the net just before retiring in water and then hang it, and that would cool the air around the person who was lying upon their sickbed. That really shows us the despicability of this gruesome sight. It is Haziel who volunteers, "O king, out of love, I'll fix your net for you." And he goes, and maybe all the other servants have left. Maybe there's just a faithful soldier or two that are part of the coup attempt. But he goes and he wets that mosquito net, and then he comes back. And when the king is perhaps even thanking him for his graciousness, he takes it and he winds it around his hands, and he leaps upon the bed and he suffocates the king until the king stops struggling, until the king is dead. What unbelievable treachery. The archaeologists have uncovered something interesting in not too distant a time. They found an Assyrian inscription that mentions King Haziel by name and his kingdom, and dates it to this point in time that we're studying. And the inscription is short, it's brief, it's cryptic. The words can almost tell you of the dislike by the one writing of this king. The inscription simply reads, "Haziel, the son of nobody, seized the throne." Consider the steps downward for this man, who was at one point in time loyal. He had risen through the ranks as the confidant of the king. He was faithful. He was trustworthy. And now his life intersected with a man who could read his heart. Now his steps would not just be one or two gradually, but now he will go down that slippery slope into dishonesty and terrible immorality. If you look at the steps once he meets the prophet, instead of repenting when the prophet pulls the mask off his heart, he defends it. He says, "Who in the world do you think I am, a dog, that I would take the lives of innocent people?" He goes back to the king and delivers half a message. Then with his own bare hands, he takes the life of the king and he steals the throne. And through the rest of 2 Kings, we will discover Elisha's prophecy come true as Haziel becomes the most brutal enemy of Israel to date. There is a progression toward ungodliness. There is a progression toward godliness. I have given you in your notes 5 steps that have been adapted from Mayer's commentary on James. You ought to carefully study through them sometime, but I want you to notice the right-hand side, the steps to making the godly choice. When facing temptation, step number 1, actively resist under divine influence. Step number 2, the impulse that has been tempted visualizes the aspects of sin, where if you fail in sin, you will begin visualizing whatever that sin will do for you, whatever you will be able to get, touch, taste, or feel. For Haziel, it was the visualization of the throne. He would be the king. He would be the power in Syria. And that captivated his mind. Step number 3, if you would be godly, the will identifies with the conscience. That still small voice, and refuses to proceed. Step number 4, the virtuous choice is committed. Now, thanks to my 2.5-year-old daughter, I've been watching a lot of Pinocchio lately. What a great story. There's a classic section in that cartoon where Pinocchio is challenged, if you've ever seen it, by Jiminy Cricket about listening to the conscience, about what temptation is all about, and how the world is filled with it. Now, let's talk about temptation as we wrap our study up. It shouldn't be strange to us that the Lord would teach us to pray, "Lead us not into temptation." It's not that we can avoid its presence, but I think that prayer simply indicates our need to recognize our weakness. There are 2 truths that I want to share with you. Truth number 1, the presence of temptation is inevitable in spite of fellowship with God. Maybe that's the surprising part. But it's never a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Doesn't matter if you have had your quiet time, if you are sharing your faith, if you are a testimony at work, you cannot ever avoid the presence of temptation. Haziel recoiled with horror at the thought that he would fall to the temptation of doing brutal things. He said, "Who do you think I am, some dog, that I would do that?" Well, he had not been that way, but he became that way. It started with a thought, "I'd like to be king." And then it involved deceit, and then a life of deception, and ultimately murder. It's true for unbelievers. It's also true for believers. That's why Paul wrote that we are to beware. We are to be careful. We are to take heed while we stand, lest we fall. The point of that is, at the very point where you believe you are the strongest, beware. At the point where you are standing, be careful. Because that is the point of attack. And what you think you would never be capable of doing at that point, that's where you will be attacked and tempted. Truth number two, the power of temptation is impossible to overcome without intervention from God. Mark it down, you cannot handle temptation alone. It demands intervention from God. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, whatever's facing you is not uncommon to mankind. It's not unique to you. But, implication, if you submit to God, He will provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear. That is, if you reach that intersection in your life where you have to make a decision between your will and your conscience and the impulse, and you say, Lord, I want to do Your will, He will mark a door with emergency escape. And it's there. And there's nothing really dignified about running for it. There's nothing very spiritual looking about just hurling yourself toward it. You may be saving your life. You cannot handle it alone. And the point I would argue with this theologian, Jiminy Cricket, is that when you are facing temptation, don't whistle for your conscience necessarily. Cry out for the grace and the power and the intervention of God. And you will discover at those times when you recognize, like the hymn writer, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, O take and seal it for thy courts above it. Moments like that when you recognize your weakness and you lean entirely upon God, you will find Him to be a shield to those who trust Him. You will find Him to be a strong tower to those who are willing to run therein. Let's pray. Father, thank You for Your word that gives us the story of a woman who trusted You through 7 tough, lonely years. Thank You for the inerrant, implied promise to us that we will one day inherit that which is incorruptible. Thank You for giving us the story of a man who failed, who eventually yielded to the worst of things. Help us to beware. With your heads bowed and your eyes closed, I want to get a little more specific, may I? Let's move temptation from the thrones of kings and coup attempts into American culture today. Someone in here might be even now planning to walk away from a difficult or what the world would categorize an impossible marriage. And you have the logic all worked out in your own heart. Perhaps someone here has just signed onto some magazine subscription and no one knows it but you. Or perhaps you'd never do that, but you did buy the latest swimsuit issue, which I refer to as socially acceptable pornography. You've begun taking steps toward that which you now cannot even imagine. Maybe there are some senior high students here who are struggling with peer pressure, and prom night is just around the corner, and the pressure is on to conform. Perhaps someone here is on the verge of yielding to the advances of some co-worker, and maybe you've been rationalizing the way you feel and what you're thinking. You're at a crossroads. Some of you might be thinking of making a job change that would be wonderful for your career but terrible for your children and wife. They would never see you. Maybe a college student is here and you're struggling with upcoming final exams and the semester end, and it's easy temptation there to take shortcuts on papers and to cheat on tests. Someone said, whenever temptation knocks, send the Lord Jesus to answer the door. The question is, who are you going to send? Maybe you need to make something right. Maybe you need to ask God to cleanse your plans and your thoughts, not yet having accomplished the deeds. Maybe you're here and you've accomplished the first steps. Ask Him for forgiveness as His child. Maybe you're here and you identify with the widow. You have had long years of loneliness and you are struggling with the penalties of your obedience and submission to His plan. And maybe you need to resubmit this morning to His Lordship, His sovereign right to do with you however he wills. Father, I pray that in all of our lives as your children, those here who know Christ personally, you'd give us the perception to see little things in which your hand moves and small sins that grow up so fast. Help us to see them early. Give us alert consciences and strong characters so that ultimately, Lord, we might glorify you with our lives, with our hearts, with our plans.